Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Justin Robert Young, your co-host on Thursday's DTNS. Many of you are aware that I do a politics podcast called Politics, 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 and recently I had an interview that I think you guys will very much enjoy. It's with Cindy Cohen. She's the executive director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we talked a lot about where her organization is going to be going in the next few years post-coronavirus. Heads up. This is an interview for a non-tech crowd. So if you hear me going over elements and news stories that would be rudimentary to the DTNS audience, please understand I was just trying to explain to the normies because they vote too. All right. Without any further ado, here is Cindy Cohen of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Welcome to the show, Cindy.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Oh, no, this is right up my wheelhouse. I'm very, very excited to talk to you about this because I think that this is probably the biggest issue that we are going to be talking about. And in fact, there was breaking news literally as I was setting up for this interview in the Senate with a motion to surveil more web traffic. But civil liberties in the age of COVID is what we are going to talk about. But from your perspective, what is the front lines of what we are going to be dealing with as the government tries to not only rebound from this pandemic, but also prepare for the next one?
Well, I think that on the civil liberties front, at least the digital civil liberties front, the question is going to be really centered around how much, you know, surveillance and how much privacy we're going to have as the government takes the steps it's taking in the name of protecting us against, the coronavirus. And, you know, we've already seen a lot of what I call COVID washing, you know,
yes.
Companies that had really bad, you know, spying on you business models, trying to rebrand themselves to partner with government and, you know, spy on you for the public good now. And I think it's really, really important that we be extremely careful and thoughtful about the steps that we take here. And I say that because, you know, I was at EFF after September 11th, and I remember, you know, a whole lot of things being rolled out publicly and then a longer list of things being rolled out secretly that were said that they were just going to be, because of the current threat. And here we are 20 years later, and many of them have proven to be not at all effective in protecting us, but yet we still can't dislodge them. And a classic example of that is the telephone records collection. You know, the government collected everybody's telephone records for well over a decade, and they didn't solve a single terrorism investigation with them. They were useless. But yet they all got collected, they all got analyzed, and they all got kept. And it wasn't until the rest of us found out about it that we were even able to scale it back, and we still haven't been able to kill it. So we have to be very careful. And as a result of that, we've kind of got a three-part test. that we think about when we think about something that gets, you know, proposed as helping, as using our data to try to help keep us safe from COVID.
No, go. Sorry. I was just sitting in rapt attention. You were singing my song here, Sydney. So please go.
I realized I was kind of talking on my
own. No. Please. The floor is yours.
Okay. So the three things we look at are, first, is it effective? You know, will this thing actually work? And that actually knocks out a whole bunch of things that people are proposing to do for COVID, mm-hmm. That really aren't going to make us any safer. And again, the easiest example for people to see about this was the telephone records collection after September 11th. For some of the location tracking apps, for instance, you know, there were the efforts were try to use things like GPS to try to tell who you were close to. Well, GPS doesn't have it's not at all precise enough to tell whether you were 6 feet from somebody.
Yeah.
So a lot of those got knocked out just as a technical matter. They weren't going to be effective to do the thing that people wanted to do. Now people have shifted, and many of the things they're looking at are looking at Bluetooth. Well, Bluetooth might be a little more effective, but Bluetooth still can't tell what floor you're on. It really can't tell whether somebody who passes you has on full PPE or no PPE.
Yeah. Let me pause you right there just so I can reset here for the audience, because many are very technically savvy, but I do want to reset just so people get a fuller context of exactly what you're talking about. Obviously, with COVID here, we are now thinking far more about the idea of contact tracing. So if you have the disease, when you find out you have the disease, specifically in this case, which has a very long asymptomatic cycle, right? So now theoretically, the best thing that you could do is go back and tell everybody that you were around that this was the case. And in some places, like China, India, they have mandated that people have GPS tracking on their phones, because theoretically that could be the technical solution. But as Cindy pointed out, it's not really all that accurate, as anybody who's tried to use GPS for walking directions in a big city will tell you, as your dot just kind of floats between blocks. It's not accurate. The next step, and this is something that has been backed by Apple and Google, is a Bluetooth system, which technically would be constantly pinging other devices with Bluetooth. And so that way, when you found out you had the disease, you could hit a button, and now everybody else that was pinged over the last 2 weeks would now know automatically that they were in a contact with somebody, and they can go get tested. But you are saying with Bluetooth, even then, it has no idea whether or not you're on the same floor. It has no idea whether or not the other person was in a full hazmat suit.
Right. And so it's better, and there might be things that we could do with Bluetooth, but it's just important that we start first with efficacy, right? Is it effective? And then the second step is it just too invasive to our rights to do, even if it might have some marginal benefit? And for us, you know, one thing that's clearly in that category is facial recognition, right? Facial recognition technology, first of all, it has real efficacy concerns, and I don't want to pass by them, but even if it was marginally effective, it's really, really dangerous in a self-governing democracy to have the government have access to all the people you ever talk to. And anything you might do for political organizing, where, you know, we're heading into a political season, it's very dangerous to do this. And you know this because dictators always want that kind of surveillance power, right? They want to know who's organizing the opposition. Like, you don't have to be a, you know, computer, you know, a political scientist to see how important it is that, you know, if you're in power, you want to know who all the people are who are trying to take power away from you. And that if you're trying to take power away from somebody, having a safe place for you to have those conversations without the government knowing is vital. So that's the second step. Is it just too worrisome from a democracy and civil liberties matter to do it, even if it might give us some benefit? And then the third thing is, if we pass those two tests, what are the guardrails? What are the things that we know we need to build in from the beginning to make sure that if we're going to roll out with this thing, it's going to operate in the way we want to. So, you know, the number one thing for this is build in the time that it's going to end. Don't make these things open-ended. You need to build
sunset
in
them. Yeah, have sunset provisions.
Yeah, and if you don't do that, believe me, they won't end. You can't kid yourself. The second thing is, what is the bias? How does this work? So if you've got a system, for instance, that assumes that everybody that is only tracking the people who have smartphones with the latest software on them, you're going to miss at least 20% of American society that don't have phones at all, or don't have smartphones, or don't have currently updated smartphones. And honestly, those people, they're the people right now who are getting coronavirus at a much higher rate than the rest of us. So what are you doing, right? How are you actually getting at the people who might need the information, right? The people who might need to know that they're at most risk, you might be excluding by the very way you're counting it. So what is the bias in how you're doing this? And then there's a bunch of other things about, like, you know, what's going to happen to the data? Are you collecting more data than you need? How are you going to secure the data? We all have lived through, you know, data breach after data breach after data breach. If you don't have a plan for keeping the data safe, then you can make people more vulnerable by collecting it than if you didn't. And how are you going to stop somebody, say, from hitting the notification to notify everybody like the day before the election, so a whole bunch of people have to self-quarantine, when you're really just trying to stop them from being able to vote? Or you walk by somebody who's your enemy and you click that, and then they have to go through a whole medical process, when what you're really doing is just, you know, doxing them or griefing them, which, you know, as we say on the internet, basically, you know, how can this tool be used as a weapon by a vengeful government or by a vengeful human? And if you aren't doing that kind of thinking, then you may be building something that is going to make people's situations worse, not better. So those are the kinds of what we call guardrails. And there's a long list of them on EFF's website if somebody wants to see in more detail. But that's the kind of process we look at for all, you know, a lot of these kind of digital COVID responses. Remember, contact tracing is not a digital thing, right? Contact tracing is an old public health thing. The digital gloss on it, even the people who think it's, or who are huge evangelists of it, will tell you that at best, it's something that is a small addition to what needs to be a manual contact tracing thing. And I saw some research out of Iceland just yesterday that says that the Icelandic authorities say that their digital contact tracing, which they have a very robust digital contact tracing, marginal at best.
Yeah.
In helping them with the strategies because of all the false positives and all the ways in which it's wrong. And so, you know, how much of our societal energy do we want to put towards something that's marginal at best, as opposed to, you know, hiring humans to do old school contact tracing, which does work?
And that's the biggest thing, is that technology isn't magic. It's just another tool that you can use. But if you don't understand it, it's very, very easy, if you're trading your civil liberties, to have it be abused. And so I would like to just really, really quick go back to the two things. Number one, just for folks who are not aware, stuff like face scanning, very much a real world issue now. If you remember any of the pictures from the Hong Kong protests, the reason why there were lasers out there weren't necessarily because they were trying to rave their way to independence, but rather so they could interfere with face scanners that was there that are being employed by the Chinese government. That being said, the big move now is the Apple and Google backed contact tracing thing. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. This at best is just a addition on top of it. And we need to focus more on some of the false positive elements of it. But what has been lauded, at least in some circles, is that it is anonymous. So it is pinging everybody. All the Bluetooth connections are anonymous. And there is no central repository of you being the one to ping stuff. What is the EFF's position on that being built in to the OSs of Android and iOS?
I mean, I think that Apple and Google really did do listening to the early concerns about this. And I think that they have built this. Now, remember, this is just an API, an application programming interface. It's not the actual.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Right now on a special edition of Tools and Weapons, Brad Smith is sharing a vision for what Microsoft calls the new AI economy. It's an idea rooted in technological revolutions of the past, like the printing press, which created a vibrant marketplace of related innovations, ultimately leading to an explosion of books and readers. But he doesn't just give a history lesson. In the episode, Brad lays out the tangible ways that Microsoft is providing infrastructure and other support to those leading the charge of the new AI economy. And he explains the importance of using that infrastructure to ensure equitable access to AI to people all over the world. To stay current on insights from voices at the center of the conversation on AI, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you like to listen. My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
App. Okay. They're building a place for an app to rest. And so a lot of the questions that are really concerning to us are probably not, they're not the ones that happen at the API level, although some are. A lot of them are, you know, what are you going to plug into the hole that Apple and Google have built for you in their app space. So I think the fact that it's anonymous and that it's decentralized is really good. And I think they've done some other good things. The proof will be in the pudding about, you know, what kind of apps do roll out to fit into this. We haven't taken, I mean, again, what we're trying to do is to help people think about how to think about it, much more so than taking a hard and fast position. And there's two reasons for that. One is that I think that it's really easy to iterate and change one thing and then change another thing and change another. You're kind of chasing the sunset to try to figure out all the different ways that people are going at this problem. So it's better, I think, for us to focus on, you know, what would something good look like rather than here's what something good is.
Yeah.
Because there's lots of ways to skin the cat. And the second thing is that we really don't have insider information about how this stuff is all working in practice. So we're only kind of able to comment on the theory. And so I also don't want to take a strong position for or against any particular technology. You know, my technologists are like, you know, until we can get our hands on it, we can't tell you whether it's actually going to do what they're saying it's going to do or how that's going to work. And, you know, most of this is nobody's fault, but most of this stuff is too new for us to be able to feel like we can say definitively, this is a good thing or this is a bad thing. We appreciate that people want to step in and technical people want to step in to try to help with this. And we're trying to lay out what it is you need to think about if you're going to this. There are other things that are really easy that technical people can do. You know, if you want to help figure out how to build open source ventilators, like that one's pretty easy, right?
Yeah.
You want to figure out how to use your 3D printer to print out repair pieces for ventilators and other medical equipment. Awesome. That's pretty easy. But some of these questions about surveillance technologies, and believe me, we haven't even talked about the second thing after COVID, after the contact tracing comes the idea of like, you know, immunity passports or immunity licenses.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Let's go. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So anyway, there's tons of things that technical people can do that don't raise these hard questions. And we really do think that that would be a great place for people to put their energy. But the stuff that involves surveillance is, it's going on. Again, there's a lot of companies that were already surveilling all of us who are looking for a really good reason to say that what they're doing was good after all. And so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of money behind trying to make a digital surveillance tool that's actually useful to the problem. So the other one that I mentioned is this idea, and they have different names, but kind of immunity passports or driver's licenses to be able to move around. And again, we apply the same three steps to these kinds of apps as well.
And this would be if there was some sort of proven way that you could say that you had the disease, you already had antibodies. Now, if there were immune only bars or restaurants, you could flash some kind of proof that indeed you had it. And now everybody inside that facility could feel at ease. That's
the idea. But, you know, it's going to get real serious real quick, right? Because it's going to be a thing you need to have before you can go to your job. It may be the thing you get, you know, like there's a lot of, so again, you do the three steps. Is it effective? Well, I don't think right now we know whether antibodies actually make you immune. So the first question that has to happen before all of this is like, is it telling anybody anything that's going to make you safer? And I think that we're, you know, I think there's some good indications that we could develop an antibody test, and that having the antibodies may mean that you have a level of immunity, at least for maybe a year or two. So there may be a time in which this is effective, but we're not there yet. And the antibody tests are all over the map about whether they're good or not, or reliable or not. And so I think it's important that, you know, start with efficacy. You can spend a lot of energy building an app that's based on a kind of flawed model of how the medicine works, and you don't want to do that. The second, they're trying as hard as they can to try to figure this out. The second thing is it just too invasive? And I think that depending on where you're putting checkpoints, it could be just too invasive, right? If you've got a checkpoint on that's going to stop people from being able to vote, then I think it's too invasive to our democracy, even if it might be somewhat helpful. There have to be other ways to try to make sure that people are not spreading the virus other than, you know, a kind of your papers, please checkpoint. For certain things, there might be certain things like, you know, do you want to go to my restaurant? I'm not going to let you in the restaurant unless you can show it. Those kinds of optional things are easy. Mandatory things are much, much harder. And then the third area is the guardrails. And that's the one where these passports or driver's licenses are really, really problematic, because if we're going to have the police enforcing them, we've had a problem in our country where, you know, driving while black or stop and frisk or lots of these kinds of things where the police have wide discretion to stop random people on the street get deployed in a very, very discriminatory way. You know, there's been lawsuits, the cops lose, like this is a known thing. And so, empowering the police to do random checks of people as they're just walking around in the world, I think is the bias opportunities there are just way too great. Now, that again, that doesn't mean there aren't situations in which it makes sense, but these are the things we need to think about when we're thinking about these kinds of things.
Can I ask just a general question about the EFF? Do you guys, obviously you do great work online, and certainly there is a massive following for your point of view there. Do you do any traditional lobbying like in DC, or do you have your eye toward that with a lot of these issues that will be up at the forefront very soon?
Oh yeah, we have we're not a lobbying organization. We're the kind of charity that can do a certain percentage of lobbying. You know, there's a charity. We're a 501c3, for those of you who know about this stuff. So that means we can do, you know, kind of somewhere between 10-20% of our budget can go towards the kind of lobbying that you're talking about, or grassroots lobbying, you know, telling people, write your congressman to pass this bill.
Yeah.
We do it. We stay, you know, we're well within the organization does lots and lots of legal cases and other things. But we definitely have we have two legislative analysts, and they do lobbying. We're actually part right now in the new federal bill. There's going to be some provisions to try to make broadband more widely acceptable, available for low-income people and rural people, because that's one of the things we've all learned as a result of the COVID crisis, mm-hmm. is that lots of people's broadband sucks and they can't do things like have their kids go to school because of it, or do their jobs. And so there's a piece of this bill that we're very supportive of, that will try to free up more money to try to make sure that everybody has access to broadband in their homes, now that we're all in our homes trying to do our jobs in school. In California, for instance, we're very active in the California legislature trying to make sure that California, you know, maintains its lead as the privacy protecting state. You know, we keep trying to make it better. And there's also a broadband for all bill in California that we're very supportive of. We think one of the things that I think all of us have learned as a result of the COVID crisis is how important the internet is, and how useful it can be to trying to keep your life going. And so this is the right time for government to really begin to address the fact that we have two big broadband companies that have made real broadband unavailable to huge swaths of our communities. And we need to move to the place where we recognize the truth, which is, you know, access to broadband is really something you need in order to function in society right now. And it can't be treated as if it's some kind of a luxury for the rich.
No, yeah. The digital divide is long past the days where it just meant you could download movies off Napster. This is now a fundamental pillar of society, and I think this crisis has certainly proven that.
I mean, it's in some ways it's the internet's day, right? I think a lot of people are really, really, really appreciating that we built ourselves a network where everyone can talk to everyone pretty cheaply and easily. And now we need to make that a reality.
I think there's also just, and this is going to get a little nerdy, but like, there's a major issue right now with uploads in general. Like, I think even people who are paying a fair amount of money that can expect a certain amount of uploads, now that everybody is uploading their own video, their live video to Zoom and Slack and Teams and Google Meet and stuff like that, I feel like our network is really, really, really straining under that. And I think it's something that's going to become more and more of a problem if this becomes more and more permanent.
Yeah, but I think that the network isn't straining under it. I think that the business model of the companies is. The network can handle uploads and downloads at the same speeds. It's like, and if not, we know the things we have to do to build it out to do more of that.
Yeah.
Right. Broadband to the home, for instance. Right. But I think that what's happened is the duopoly, the two companies that provide us with most people with their internet service have used the upload download difference to try to, you know, basically do price discrimination to make people charge more for uploads. And now all of us need the upload. And so we need to shift that business model, because it's not serving how we need the internet to work now. And for me, I say hallelujah. I always thought that, you know, trying to make the internet something where we were consumers in the same way we were consumers of television, as opposed to something that's a two-way street where we get to create and not just receive others' creations, is one of the great things that the technology can do for us. And so hallelujah, you know, people are really using this time to build creativity, to do their TikToks or whatever videos that they're wanting to do. And that's what the internet can do for us. Gosh, hallelujah.
I agree. All right. So is there anything else that you have on your radar aside from contact tracing and the immunity passports as it results to where we see the coming battles with a post-COVID world?
Well, I think that I alluded to this a little bit, but I think there's a lot of creativity going on around open access to knowledge, sharing knowledge, not having things all bottled up into proprietary systems, where we see a lot of people doing things. And again, you know, the open source ventilator project, a lot of work, you know, the Internet Archive has tried to make, you know, far more information available so that teachers can use it to teach their kids, digital reading, digital access to media, because, you know, kids can't go in and get their school books anymore and can't go into the library and do research. So, you know, making libraries really go digital and that information be freely available for the teachers and other people who need it. You know, people, again, kind of freeing up repair manuals and other kinds of information so people can DIY or otherwise help fix these things. So, you know, some of these, like, kind of, again, I think they're business models, but business models based on scarcity of information are looking, I think, more and more like a bad idea for society because, you know, we need to scale up. We need to scale up fast for a lot of medical equipment and personal protective equipment, and keeping the knowledge of how to do that and how to do that right, you know, locked up for a price, is just not serving society right now. And so that's part of where the really exciting stuff goes. And you know, I think that, you know, there are people who are invested in those old school business models who are going to, who aren't liking it. And we're going to start to see some battles around that. You know, if you have a manual for how to fix, you know, a ventilator and you make it public, the ventilator company should not be suing you for copyright infringement. They should be thanking you and supporting you for helping make sure that more people can have the benefit. But I'm not sure how that's going to go down. So so that's a thing that I think we see as a possibility and we hope doesn't happen. And there's a pledge right now for people who are developing the COVID medicine. This is a little outside of EFF's wheelhouse, but not all of it, but is, you know, for people who are developing vaccines or medications, to sign an open open intellectual property pledge, so that, you know, people don't end up having to pay their whole life savings in order to get treatments or vaccines. And there's a good pledge that my friend Mark Lemley at Stanford had a little bit to do with, that they're really pressuring the companies, both, you know, again, both the pharmaceutical companies and the other companies who are building some of these things to sign, to make sure that the, you know, most of the, you know, huge chunk of the money that goes into developing these systems is actually government money, right? And so we as the people who need the access to it should have more access to the fruits of that labor.
Well, Cindy, thank you so much for coming on. I really think that the EFF, I can't think of another organization that has put in the time and effort for as long as the EFF has in terms of thinking about digital civil liberties and being a voice for not only the citizen, but also the consumer, specifically in the issues like we were talking about with upload and stuff like that. And now I think that you guys are in a very, very interesting position, because I do think we are going to get overarching legislation. I do think that we are going to get technological solutions that will be backed by the government. And unlike the Patriot Act, I believe we have a populace that is digitally literate enough to understand how overreaching and how wrong some of these solutions can go if they don't implement some of the common sense stuff that you guys are talking about. So thank you for coming on and talking about it.
Oh, totally my pleasure. And I sure hope you're right. We're certainly going to be there to try to lead the charge, but we do need as many people to make their voices heard as possible. By the way, we are, one of the personal things that, you know, personal things happen is EFF is turning 30 years old this summer. Our birthday is in July, and we had a whole huge party planned that we're going to have to move. We're going to have to move another thing to do. But it is a really, I think, an important time, and I really appreciate you recognizing that. You know, we've kind of been in the trenches on this for a long time. We're ready, we're smart, and, you know, we're not babies, so we yeah. know how to navigate in this world, and so we're ready for this challenge.
Well, thank you very much, Cindy, and thank you all, the DTNS faithful, for listening. If this is up your alley, then you might want to check out the Politics podcast, 2 episodes a week for free on the internet. Till the next time, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, signing off.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences, Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.